Dooling.
Again! Another three-pointer for Keon Dooling. And the Celtics are 6 of 8 from downtown.
2012 was a great year for NBA player Keon Dooling. He went with the Boston Celtics all the way to the Eastern Conference Finals. After the season was over, the Celtics re-signed him to a $1.4 million contract. But then, during the offseason, everything changed.
So after I signed with the Celtics, I was in Seattle, Washington, doing some charity work. And I go to the restroom, and as I'm using the restroom, a guy feels on me. I felt this rage just in this boom, 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 just kind of brewing within me. And so at that moment, anger took me, and I actually choked the guy who felt on me in that moment. And I'm so thankful that a good friend was there to pull me off of him. And I came back to myself and kind of got out of there and really started suffering from PTSD instantly.
Dooling says he couldn't sleep, he couldn't eat, and ultimately he decided to leave the NBA. The PTSD that Dooling felt was the result of a childhood trauma, one that he had spent his entire life trying to ignore.
I was sexually abused when I was 7 years old, and I didn't share it with anybody. It happened at the hand of a teenage boy, and I think that made me not only angry, but embarrassed, and I decided at a very early age to not tell anybody. And so I went through life navigating, never getting healing, never getting tools, never even talking about my experience. And I carried that throughout my life until the day that I got triggered and I was forced to kind of do my work.
That work, it was something he had never considered before, therapy.
You know, I think men were told to suck it up, be tough, don't cry, don't complain. And, you know, some of those things are just so unnatural. They tell us not to cry, but our first language we speak is crying. If we're not crying, they'll slap us on the butt and make sure we cry because that's a part of what makes us normal. And we have these wonderful things called tear ducts. And so I think a lot of men, we can relate to anger and pleasure. But what I learned in the therapy process is that there are so many emotions in between there that I did not understand. And therapy allowed me to kind of process those things, process what I was feeling, and be able to give me some tools to manage the different emotions as they come.
Before you went to therapy, before you decided to get treatment, had it ever crossed your mind to see a therapist?
No, not at all. I believe that, you know, therapy has a negative stigma. And so in my community in particular, you know, there's words like shrink, head doctor, the crazy house, all those different things. And interesting stat, I think it's less than 6% of black men get therapy. And I believe we come from some of the most, if not the most traumatic experience in this country. I didn't understand it. I didn't appreciate it. I didn't value it. And I just never embraced mental health until I went through my own mental health challenges.
And I want to, you mentioned our community. I want to talk a little bit about that specifically, about the unique issues, not just for men and mental health, but men of color, in your case, black men. In your piece, you wrote that you were channeling all of your rage and anger into sports. And you say, quote, "I had to show everybody that I was strong, that I was an alpha, that I was nobody to mess with." Is that a unique experience to black men in America, that level upon level of masculinity?
Well, I'm not sure. I can't speak for every other community. I think men across the board are extremely macho and egotistical and territorial. So we butt heads a lot. But, unique to our experience in this country, yeah, you have to be tough. You know, a lot of times if you grow up in an area where there's a lot of poverty, you're going to be exposed to a lot of things, and you have to learn how to survive, and you learn survival skills. But those aren't the only things that you learn, but those are some key components that you're able to take with you. And as far as the channeling all my anger, it wasn't just channeled through sports, even though I was able to tap into it. But I also acted out with whether it was drinking or smoking or being promiscuous. And so sometimes the acting out just doesn't come through aggressiveness. Sometimes it comes through hurting yourself and your behaviors.
And I think we see a lot of that, at least historically, with men, right, that are much more aggressive, even when it comes to things like suicide. Until recently, men have been more apt to be more violent, right, in these types of things. So the things that you're describing, acting out, drinking, promiscuity, all of these things seem to be things that men are taught or feel as though that's the only way that they can express their feelings.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point. And I want to shift that narrative because I think we're much more than just being, you know, banging on our chest and aggressive. What I've learned is that through the therapy process in particular, you know, I can be more than just a protector. I can be a nurturer. I can be vulnerable. I can be honest. I can be, you know, embarrassed. You know, there's a whole bunch of things we feel or experience, and we don't always have to have aggressive reactions. And so I think, you know, us as men, we have to start doing our work and developing ourselves. I don't think we ever really process our experience. And so there's a lot of baggage that I believe everybody is carrying with them. And if somebody pushes the wrong button, boom, you have an opportunity to be triggered and have an opportunity to explode.
How do you talk about mental health to other men now? I mean, you said it's very important that men, you know, recognize that there are other emotions and go to therapy. But do you have those conversations with the men that you know?
Yes, absolutely. Just recently, you know, this month alone, 10 of my friends or family members or mentees have gone and started their first session of therapy. And so, you know, being able to speak, you know, the language and be vulnerable enough to share my experience with therapy is encouraging to them. And I think we don't see enough examples of men being vulnerable. We celebrate accomplishments, but we don't celebrate the process that it takes in order to become successful. And yeah, I share those conversations and I make them so normal. And it wouldn't work if my life hadn't shifted and they couldn't see change in me. And so those promiscuous behaviors that I had, I don't have them anymore because I worked through them. Those anger issues that I had, well, I'm a little bit more zen now because I probably have already done yoga or meditated before I left the house. And so just useful tools that have helped me, I want to share because I'm living my best life right now. And I want everybody else who might be carrying some baggage to get that opportunity because it feels so good.
And also, I'm wondering how we get past the cultural stigma. I know in Latino families and Latino communities, which my family is, you know, there can be cultural barriers to talking about therapy. Do you find similar barriers if you're talking to someone who happens to be a person of color, a Black man, a Latino man, somebody who might have that added layer?
Yeah, I would say 5 years ago, it was a very difficult conversation. But now I see it shifting. I see that there's a lot of people in my community who understands that, hey, healing is available. Resources are out there and I want to get better. And I think they're starting to do it. And I think the reason why people are so comfortable doing it now is because there's other examples of people being vulnerable enough to share their testimony to help people endure and find their healing. And also, I would say that the lack of resources sometimes in these urban communities is something that doesn't allow people to get the help that they need. And so that's a real thing as well, because my therapy was not cheap.
Now, a significant percentage of people who commit abuse as adults have also been abused as children. And we've mm-hmm. seen this happen with the Juno Diaz story, with the Sherman Alexie story. As a survivor of sexual abuse yourself, how do you feel when you see this coming up, whether it's as an excuse or an explanation for alleged misconduct?
Yeah, no, it hurts. You know, it hurts, you know, to see somebody have to endure with that, because when you go through abuse, you don't come out of it the same. You know, I lost my innocence at 7 years old and I suffered with anxiety for a great part of my life. I had anger issues. I had promiscuous behaviors. And so you don't get out of it unscathed. Right. I do think that there is a place, you know, this is a great conversation, because I think, you know, people who hurt people and they continue that cycle. And I think that there's a lot of people who have made mistakes who need to get their healing as well. And whether that's the victim or the predator, you know, I just think that there's room for healing and growth and accountability so that we can have a real discussion about sexual abuse, because it's happening in safe havens. It's happening in churches, in families, in schools. It's happening in the workplace. And so if we never talk about it, we can never change it.
What does masculinity mean to you today? And how do you define healthy masculinity?
So today, healthy masculinity to me is being a protector of my family, being a provider of my family, and also being vulnerable enough to love on my family and sensitive enough to share with my family and cry with my family and smile with my family and be goofy with my family. And so that's what masculinity. Masculinity to me is just being accountable and being a stand up person. What it used to be to me is that I needed to be the dominant figure. I need to dominate by any means necessary. And I don't think that form of masculinity is the one that's going to get us over the top.
Keon Dooling is a former NBA player, and he's also an author and life coach. Keon, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.